Welcome to the Boulder Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Joel Davis. Thanks for joining me today. I'm here with Spike Ilakwa, the founder of Indra and a longtime tech player in Boulder and on the Front Range. And we're going to talk today about what it's like to be involved in tech on the Front Range for over 25 years now. Spike, welcome to the Boulder Tech Podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
These days, it's pretty easy to get into tech. Just about everyone already has a computer. But you've been in tech for over 30 years. How did you get into it?
I started playing around with computers in the late 80s, which was a pretty uncommon thing at the time, I'd say. My dad worked at a university, and I was actually able to get in and play with some of their computers. My high school, my senior year, got its first and only computer. And imagine today, you know, kids all have their own Chromebooks, plus probably a phone. But back then, my school had one computer we all had to share.
Yeah, I remember. And you and I, we graduated from high school the same year, 1984, the best year to graduate high school.
Clearly.
And I remember my senior year taking BASIC, but not really getting in at all. And that was pretty much it for me for computers until a couple of years into my college career when my parents, who were fortunately kind of early adopters on a lot of things back then, got me an Apple IIc.
I had the exact same computer.
To type term papers on and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so I went to Boston University and I went for computer science, or they called it at the time computer engineering. And you talked about the Apple IIc. I actually bought one the end of my senior year of high school. My parents helped out. I saved up my money from working in the gas station and bought one. And I had the only computer on my dorm floor of 80 people. And I was very popular. I made a lot of beer trading it so that people could write their term papers on it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, even at that big university, you had to go down to the computer lab and wait in line and, you know, get your half an hour on the computer before they kicked you out. It was a very different world.
So were you interested in coding and writing software from the beginning?
Yeah, I was definitely, you know, wanted to be a coder. And, you know, my time at university, it was very different than it is now because nobody quite knew how to teach programming. So I had classes in maybe a dozen different languages. Nobody knew what people were going to be doing. It was clear that this was important and the world was going to need a lot of programmers. But what language that would be, what operating system, nobody knew. So they just kept throwing into different classes. But the one thing they didn't teach me was a language called C, which descendants of are still used for a lot of things like mobile development. And I taught myself that just because it kind of like clicked with me. And that was fortunate because my first job out of college was actually programming in that language, the one language they didn't teach me.
And where was that job?
It was a little startup whose name I can't even remember anymore.
Eventually, that led to a job at The World.
The World, yeah.
And what is The World's claim to fame?
The World's claim to fame is it was the first internet service provider, the first ISP.
And what year is this?
This is 88, okay. 89. So a friend of a friend actually was starting up a consultancy. He wanted people who knew how to do programming on Unix servers, and there weren't a lot of people around. So he hired me and one of my roommates and went off and looked for business and didn't find a lot of it. But one of the things that I set up for him was an email server and a Usenet news server. Usenet was a kind of like Google Groups or Yahoo Groups before those things ever existed. And in the late 80s, that's what people did with the internet and the sort of pre-internet was they either sent email or they read these. Basically, you could think of them as bulletin boards. And he was really addicted to them. So he had me set that up so that he could do that because he had had it at his university job before that. Well, it turned out there were a lot of other people who had had that access to that at universities or, you know, a lot of defense contractors. There wasn't a lot of stuff on the internet at that time. And when they left those jobs, they missed it and they would call them up and say, hey, can you let us use your machine? And so eventually we turned that into a business, put in a bunch of modems and we were off and running. And then as the internet evolved, we eventually got permission to actually sell access to the internet and as opposed to just to email. And that's how we came the first ISP.
And this is over 14.4 dial-up modem.
Oh, nowhere near that fast. We're talking 300, 1200. Mm-hmm. I think 14.4 was coming out about the time I left.
Okay.
And so I was there for 5 years, 6 years. And then around 1994, the web started to appear. And I thought this was going to be something big, and the founder of the company disagreed. And while now in hindsight I seem like a genius and he seems like an idiot, the truth is that back then there were a lot of competing visions of what the network would be. The most popular thing at the time was AOL, so a lot of people thought that that was kind of like you'd have one app and everything would be in it, and maybe they'd be competing services like AOL, but not that, you know, every company would have its own presence on the in their own infrastructure and that sort of thing. So right. He was kind of more in that camp. And I'm like, I don't know. I think this web thing might be important. And I was then, you know, in my, later 20s, middle 20s. And I kind of, you know, wanted to do my own thing and be making more decisions. And so I kind of started looking around to do something different. And a friend of mine was interested to move to Boulder. And she said, well, you know, why don't you move to Boulder and start an ISP there? They probably need one. And so we moved to Boulder and started InrisNet.
And that was in 1994.
94, yep.
And that company is still in business.
Still in business.
And you were the CTO?
CTO, founder, guy who empties the trash cans. I don't know. No, I'm not. It's not that small. We have about half a dozen people who work mostly in tech support. Answering the phones and helping people.
Has InrisNet's mission or focus changed over the last 25 years? Are you still an ISP?
We're not really an ISP. Yeah, the mission has definitely changed. It's been a very long sort of, it's almost gone full circle. So when we started in 94, we had dial-up modems, and mostly what people did with us was email. We did a little bit of web hosting, but if you can imagine it, in 94, most people didn't have a website, didn't want a website. Big companies didn't have websites. Email was more important to people because they wanted to put that on their business card or in their Yellow Pages ad. And so we did that for a long time. But eventually, and the web part of the business grew as more and more people used the web, we moved into the colocation business, which is where you have a data center and people bring their servers to you and you take care of all the infrastructure, connecting to the internet, having the, you know, generators and backup power and all that. And so at our height, we were doing, you know, dial-up, DSL, high-speed connectivity for business and the data center, plus email and web hosting. But as times change, those businesses have kind of commodified. So, you know, eventually CenturyLink and Comcast got into the connectivity business. And since they own the wires, you really can't compete with them. The colo business slowly went away due to the rise of the cloud. People would much rather have virtual servers that they don't have to own, and that, you know, Amazon just throws it in the trash and gets them a new one if something goes wrong. So that business sort of faded away. And we did do a lot of web development in the past, but again, that kind of got replaced by the Wixes and the WordPresses and the Squarespaces of the world. So these days, Indra is just doing email and hosting websites, mostly for local businesses. There are a surprisingly large number of people who have Indra.com email addresses that they've had for more than 25 years now and would, you know, not want to give up. So
like a 212 or 303 area code.
Yes, exactly.
What's the most surprising thing that's come from running a company for so long?
I think it's the, you know, sort of the longevity of the customers. That, I mean, we literally have people who have been with us for 25 years and are, you know, don't want, you know, they're just happy and they're, you know, going to stay as long as we're willing to have them. That's really nice. And I think, you know, one thing I learned would be the importance of customer service. The reason that we still have any customers is that while all these businesses have commodified, so internet access, web hosting, whatever, when they commodify, they don't get good support. Like, you can't call up WordPress and expect them to help you. You can't. Anyone who's ever called CenturyLink or Comcast knows what that experience is. Mm-hmm. But the fact that, you know, we have good people who will take all the time you need to walk you through whatever it is you need help with has really been a strong point, really the thing that's kept us going. So one of the interesting things, I guess this would be one of the surprising things about running this business, is that you never call the cable company to ask them how to program your VCR. Or if you did, they'd laugh and hang up, right? But you'd call your internet service provider and ask them why your grandmother didn't get her email, or why your grandmother can't send email, or, you know, what's up with your antivirus software, all these sort of things, because people have no one else to talk to about their computers. So they talk to Indra, they talk to us. And it's just interesting that like, where in any other business, you wouldn't expect, you know, to call the person you built your house to ask about your stove, you know, but in a computer business or an internet business, they're just like, oh yeah, these people are the internet. So anything that's even possibly related to the internet, we should talk to them about. And we try to help them because nobody else will.
And that seems like probably a big differentiator for you, and certainly a great source of comfort really for your customers to know that they can call and someone's going to actually pick up the phone.
Yeah.
Or call them back very quickly. Mm-hmm. Because when I think about, oh man, I got to call the cable company because my internet's down. What are all the things that I can do?
Yes.
To try to fix it.
To avoid making that call. Yes.
Before I have to call them.
Yes.
And so what was the tech scene like in Boulder when you started Indra's Net? Was there even a tech scene?
There was. And people today don't realize that Boulder was actually quite the hotbed of the early internet. CU's CS department had a big focus on Unix servers and working with them, stuff we'd call DevOps these days. And there are a number of early Unix pioneers who were at CU. And so there were a lot of people coming out of there who really had the skill set to get going with the early web. A number of them got together and created an organization called the Colorado Internet Co-op, which Indra ultimately was a part of. Because back then, you know, this is say 93, 94, internet came in two forms, a dial-up that was maybe 14.4 by then, or a T1 connection, which was a high-speed connection. I think it was 1.5 megabits, so maybe, you know, 40 times slower than your Wi-Fi connection these days. And so there wasn't a lot of infrastructure, and the Colorado Internet Co-op pulled their money up and bought a bigger connection. I think it was 20-something T1s worth of bandwidth. And they had to actually bring it down from Wyoming because that was the closest place to Boulder that had a high-speed internet connection that belonged to Sprint, I believe.
It seems a little backwards somehow.
Yeah, totally backwards. It's because of the rail lines. They were running fiber along the rail lines through Wyoming, and they hadn't brought it into Colorado yet. And so these people got their money together and actually paid for them to bring the connection down along the rail lines to Boulder. And so because of that, there were a whole bunch of sort of early internet startups that were here, and there was actually a lot of going on. There was a big Unix meetup and a big internet meetup, and, you know, a lot of the kind of things you see today. Obviously they weren't called meetups then, but those sort of groups of, you know, people who program this language and people who work with this technology kind of stuff that you see now was actually going on. Two big companies that I can think of from that time were there was a company called Xor, which did a lot of work getting big brands like Fortune 500 companies to just have their first website. There was another company called Email Publishing that was like one of the first companies that was sort of solving the, you know, how do you email all your customers? How do they unsubscribe? All that kind of stuff that we take for granted now. They were like developing that technology. So it was actually pretty busy. But then the dot-com boom and bust came. So most of them either got bought up and moved away or just sort of failed when everybody decided the internet was done.
My next question was going to be, did you think that back when you started Indra that Boulder would become the tech hub that it is today? But it sounds like you're saying Boulder has always been that tech hub, and it's had its ebbs and flows, but tech has always been a thing here.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know exactly when that started, but I think there has been a bit of that. Around the time we're talking about, there was also a lot of, you know, there was the big IBM plant out on the diagonal. There was, what was their name? the tape company, Exabyte. I mean, they were huge, you know. They got killed by hard drives, but, you know, they were a ginormous company that they were all over Boulder. Like, every building down around 30th and Arapaho was that company. There was a lot of stuff out in Longmont, two hard drive companies. So there's always been a strong tech component here.
Would you say that there is a specific dividing line between Front Range Tech 1.0 and whatever we have now?
Yeah. I'd say, you know, when the dot-com bubble popped, we'll call that 99, 2000, things definitely slowed down around here. A lot of those big companies I talked about went out of business. Exabyte went out of business. You know, IBM was already in trouble, and they, you know, pulled out a lot of their stuff, and, you know, all, and the little companies were crushed, you know, and there definitely seemed to be less going on for a long time. But then I would say I really noticed it picking up again around 2008, 2009. That's when all of a sudden there were a lot of user groups springing up and a lot of activities and little conferences and things like that. So there's definitely a resurgence then. And it was different. It is different. I think there were a lot more sort of startup-y companies, a lot of small things going on, where the stuff of the 90s tended to be bigger. And that was always the goal. You know, we want to buy, we want to hire, we want to have, 500 employees, that kind of thing. I see less of that these days.
Leaner and meaner.
And
going back to that first dot-com bubble bursting, was Indra in danger of?
No. I mean, it was kind of funny. Is my perspective on the whole thing. I saw it coming. And again, you didn't have to be a genius to see it coming when people are spending, like, you know, huge amount of monies on stupid things. Mm-hmm. But I certainly didn't think it was going to be as hard as it was. And the thing that I knew right then that this was just a bump in the road was that it really didn't affect us. Some people maybe closed their websites. Nobody stopped using the internet. And we definitely began to see that people would be more likely to say give up their Yellow Pages ad than give up their website. Mm-hmm. Like, whether or not you were making bazillions of dollars with pets.com didn't matter. Like, you needed a website. People, that was how people were finding you, and people were understanding that, right? And these were just, you know, basic brochure sites. Here's our phone number, here's our hours kind of stuff. We're talking before the Yelp and the Google stuff, where you just find that without even needing to go to someone's site. So we never really saw a drop off in our business.
You mentioned that part of the reason that that bubble burst was because people were spending ridiculous amounts of money on bad ideas. Mm-hmm. Now we're in the VC thing is big and a lot of companies are being financed that way. Do you see those same mistakes being made, or is the money being invested a little more wisely?
I think it's both. There are proven solid ways to make money using the internet, obviously. And I think there are a lot of people who invest wisely, and a lot of people are going to do fine. But I do think that there's some of that same hype, some of that over enthusiasm, you know. The big one people throw out is Uber. It's like their valuation only makes sense if they have self-driving cars. But so far they managed to stay in business. So, mm-hmm. You know, I don't know. You know, I suspect there's going to be a tightening. I don't think it will be as serious as it was in the 90s. Because I think we don't know everything that the internet and technology can do now, but we know it can do a lot of things. And we know some of those things won't go away. If the 2.0 bubble pops, it's not like Amazon's going away, right? Mm-hmm. It's a more stable thing. It's a shift. Like, I'm not sure how to describe it, but if you think about it, at the time of the first dot-com thing, people were trying to figure out things to do with the internet. Like, it's new, it's novel, we're making up things to do. And now we're still making up things to do, but it's not about what do we do with the internet. It's just like, this is another tool. Like, obviously we're going to be on the internet. So it's just part of business, right? Every business uses this stuff. Every business has some technological component. It doesn't matter what they do. You know, car companies these days are technology companies. Like, John Deere is a software company. I mean, it's just part of the nature of business, of how the world works. And some ideas are stupid and will fail, and some ideas will succeed. And that's always the way it's been.
As someone who grew up in the analog era, as you know, as an analog kid, and then crossed that bridge into the digital world in our 20s, do you see, in my opinion, or something I feel that's missing from the internet is that human, that analog connection.
Yeah.
And do you see that as being a potential growth area for the internet, or something that is needs to happen or is going to happen, or am I just going to have to get used to
a completely
digital world?
I hope not. I hope you don't have to get used to that. I mean, as someone who's been there from the beginning, I was very hopeful at the beginning, and I talked about that Usenet thing, which was the Google Groups, Yahoo Groups-esque thing. And that was so cool because the internet, or even it was more of even the pre-internet, was small. And you might be on a group for your car, right? And the person who designed it might be on the group, because that was kind of like how the internet was. To be on the internet, you had to be involved in big things. You had to be working for a car company or a defense contractor or something like that. So you could have conversations with like the people who invented this and the people who invented that, and, you know, or just the world's leading expert on whatever, you know, funky thing you were into, because that's where those people were. And that was really a nice connection. I once described it as like, it was just the world's biggest car, you know, cocktail party, and everybody was there. Like anyone you ever wanted to talk to who was alive and active in whatever it was you're interested was probably there, because everybody wanted to be in this new technology. And we definitely lost that, right? I mean, the internet today is a big, loud, angry mess. Though there are rays of hope. I mean, like the Wikipedia is a great example of something everyone swore would never work. Oh, that's stupid. Like, people will just lie a lot, and, you know, and nobody will ever donate money to it, and nobody will ever put content in it. And it's like, this is the greatest collection of human knowledge that ever existed. So it's not all bad, for sure. But I do think it's a mess. And I do think that a big part of that mess is sort of that loss of analog connection. Everybody, like, you don't have the nuance, the subtlety. There's plenty of connection. You can talk to everybody. You know, all my relatives who I would have never talked to are on Facebook or whatever. But there's no nuance in these conversations. Everything seems like everybody's yelling, and, you know, everybody assumes the worst about what the other person is saying. And how we get that around to something that is more human, that is more personal, you know, where when you're talking to somebody and you say something, you're like, you're reading their body language and you're reacting. And we just don't get that in the digital world. And I don't know what fixes that. But I do think, A, it's important if our civilization is going to survive. And B, yeah, it's a huge opportunity. You can make the internet a place that's more friendly and open and connected, I think people will want that.
What's the most exciting thing happening for you right now in terms of technology, the internet?
I don't know. I mean, the problem with having done this for so long is I'm kind of jaded. So, you know, everyone talks about the next big thing, and I'm like, yeah, people have been talking about the next big thing as long as I can remember.
And now the next big thing happens so quickly that it doesn't even feel like that big a thing. It's just like, boom, and there's another one, and here's another one.
Or the reverse, where they're like, hype, and then it's just like, oh yeah, sorry, like, oh, self-driving cars is like, you know, we're going to have them this year, and we're going to have them next year. And now people who take this stuff seriously are like, well, maybe 2030, maybe 2050, and things get overhyped and then have to be walked back.
Yeah, it reminds me of the band called We Were Promised Jetpacks.
Yes, I still complain about my lack of a flying car. And I do find that funny. It's like, I notice people are always complaining about video conferencing. And it's like, for free, you can see somebody halfway around the world and have a meeting with them and not have to get out of your pajamas. And you're complaining about it not being perfect.
Yeah.
So our expectations change quickly. But, you know, to talk about what, I don't know what's next, but I have an idea that, well, look at it this way. We've talked about a lot about the 90s when Andersnet started. We look at pictures of people in the 90s. They have these giant phones that do nothing other than make phone calls, which is just weird. And they have these computers with these huge low-res monitors. If you ever see pictures of them, like videos of them, you know, you have the line scrolling and they look horrible. And now today, if you looked at us, we have these giant, beautiful color monitors, and we have this square thing of glass in our pocket that we're always looking at. And so we're talking 20 years, right? Probably less than 10 that we've had our lovely phones and our flat screen monitors and all that. So what in 10 years, you know, it would not be surprise me at all if we don't have a phone in our pocket, if we have something else.
Mm.
If we don't have monitors on our desk, I do think that, you know, wearables are going to be a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever it is, like, if you take yourself back to the 80s or the 90s, this world is unrecognizable. That world is unrecognizable to, say, my son, who's, you know, 13 now. He, like, can't imagine a phone that plugs into the wall.
Right. Or I wonder how many listeners to this podcast are like,
what?
What are the yellow pages?
Yes.
What are these yellow pages you speak of?
It was like the internet in a big book. Yeah. But all it had in it was a list of the businesses in your town.
Yes. And it arrived on your doorstep whether you wanted it or not.
No. Sometimes it still does.
Yeah.
So the change is inevitable. I think the big things are obviously that wearables, machine learning, AI, whatever you want to call it, computers are definitely getting better at. I mean, it's funny, people make a big deal about machine learning, but really it's statistics at a huge scale. Like, we can look at some data and tell you something about it based on statistics. But statistics isn't sexy and VC don't invest in it. But ultimately, I mean, that stuff is getting better and better, and it can tell us more and more about the world, and it can tell the world more and more about us. So that's where things are going. What I don't know is that for good or for evil?
Right. Like, it seems like a lot of things are moving towards, and a guest that I've had on the podcast in the past, Daniel Scrivener, I asked him what he thought the next big thing was going to be. And he said, voice. We don't have I don't really use Siri that much. We don't have an Echo or whatever they're called in our house. And I'm personally, being an old school kind of analog kid, I'm reluctant to go down that road, but I don't know. Maybe that's somehow a way to return the analog.
Yeah,
the analog to this.
You know, yeah. You talk about voice. I definitely agree. It's funny. Every once in a while, like, I'll ask Siri to do something, and she'll get it totally wrong. Right? Actually, more than every once in a while, and I get annoyed. And then I think to myself, you know, someday I'm gonna look back on this as I talk to my voice assistant, the way I look back on, like, when my PC took 10 minutes to boot. Right?
Right.
It just won't be a thing. Like, you know, the voice recognition will just get it, and it'll just work, and I won't have to say it three times and enunciate, and, you know.
Exactly. And that's what this other guest was saying, was, you know, now voice is really used for very trivial things. What's the weather? Change the channel. Play me a song. All things that you can do. It's just a matter of convenience. Right. It's really not informing you of anything.
And bluntly, it's usually kind of inconvenient because you have to do it three times.
Yeah. The one conversation I had with Siri, I was asking her something. It was kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
But basically, it's the futile effort of asking Siri for an opinion.
Right.
Which, of course, Siri doesn't offer opinions. And I said, Siri, you'd be a lot more interesting if you had your own opinion. And she said, well, you're certainly entitled to your opinion, Joel.
Nice.
Which I ended the conversation.
Well, I joked about video conferencing earlier, you know, and it is one of those things when you think about what it is, like, in our youth, that was something that, you know, was in comic books or whatever. Now it just exists.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think it's not awesome, and it's not connecting somehow. Somehow it's still different than sitting in the room with somebody. And so maybe there's improvement there too.
Holograms,
there you go. One thing that people pointed out about video conferencing, I hadn't thought about that, but is that, like, you can't actually look somebody in the eye when you're video conferencing.
Yeah.
Because the camera's up here and they're down there. Maybe that improves. Maybe there, you know, there's probably a lot of little things like that that we are not even thinking about that will just make it seem more connected or be more connected.
So to take it a little more locally, do you have any thoughts on how the tech and startup scene is impacting Boulder as a city?
Yeah, I think we're in a very interesting period. I'm seeing more of a migration out of Boulder of the sort of startup-y, people just getting into the biz kind of thing. There seemed to be a lot more meetups and groups and conferences happening in places like Denver than here. I think it has a lot to do with the housing issues in Boulder. It's just very expensive. Everybody I know who's kind of that, you know, obviously I'm old and settled and I live in Boulder, but you know, younger people I interact with and are friends of mine have generally moved because it's just expensive to be here if you're young and early in your career and, you know, not making as much as you someday will. It can be a hard place to live. You know, I think Boulder has benefited from having Google here, you know, Twitter, Amazon, and other big companies like that. But those companies aren't startup material. You know, they're not attracting that kind of talent, that kind of energy. And I think that's moving to Denver because Denver is bigger and diverse and, you know, has its cheap neighborhoods and all that. I think Boulder should be worried about that. I think we should be striving to be a diverse community and not just a bedroom community. But obviously, there hasn't been a lot of progress on, you know, how do we increase the housing stock? How do we make it possible to live here if you're not at the top of the food chain in some organization?
With all of the very smart people working in the tech biz along the Front Range and in Boulder, do you think that they can, that community can be a big contributor to solving some of these problems in Boulder? Housing, transportation, diversity. Can the tech community provide that? Do you think they're even at the table? Is there interest?
I think there's definitely interest. I mean, I think people, a lot of people in tech are aware of the issue and think about it. I think that techies in general don't understand how hard politics is. The tech mindset, and I'm guilty of this too, you just like see an answer and like, oh, this is the answer. And maybe it is the answer, but you have to sell the answer, that you have to change people's minds, that you have to convince them that this is, you know, win-win, not that they lose because, you know, more people can live in Boulder or whatever. It's very, very hard. So I honestly don't know. I would definitely like to see the tech community solve this or work on solving it and be at the table and you know, say this is what, if Boulder is going to have a strong, diverse tech industry, then this is what we need. And I don't think that's happening in any large organized way.
Do you think the city is open to that?
I don't know. I mean, they should be. Boulder is very lucky, and hopefully the city recognizes that, that to be a town of this size with this sort of outsized influence in the tech world, the companies that are here, the companies that have started here, the people that are here, you know, this is really special. And it's definitely something the city should be interested in nurturing so that we can continue to have this, you know, beautiful city and have the money for the things we like open space, and be a successful community.
How do you balance the tech and the analog in your life?
Poorly. I do try to unplug and get out and be in the world, ride my bike. And when I put down the device for the day and when I'm willing to pick it up and step away from things.
Are you good at self-enforcing those rules?
Depends. I go through cycles of being better and being worse. I do think it's a, you know, it's another thing I think about with the changing tech over the course of my life is this, it's just how hard it is to unplug now. I got my first pager in the late 80s and I've been on call ever since, you know, quite literally. And I don't think that in general, it's great that, you know, we don't have off, that you can't just let, you know, the call go to voicemail or, because everybody knows you're standing there with your phone, you're mm-hmm. seeing it ring. You can't, you know, you get your texts, your messages all the time. I like the idea of do not disturb, but I don't use it enough. And I do think that that's another thing the world needs and another opportunity as weird as it seems, we need tech to protect us from tech and to make our quiet spaces and our personal spaces and things like that. And I don't know exactly what that looks like, but I do think that people are just a little on edge because they're just, you're constantly available, whether it's personally or professionally, you're just, you know, constantly available unless you get up and turn off your devices and, you know, mute them or whatever, and people don't. And something that like helps you with that, I think definitely has real value.
Even if it's like a self-imposed exile of going camping for the weekend and being out of range, or I was just traveling out of the country in a place where the internet is not on 24/7 all over the place. You had to find little spots where you could get on the Wi-Fi for $2 an hour. And even then the Wi-Fi was spotty, and it was actually really nice.
Yes.
To just...
I agree. I really like going camping and just turning my phone off. And then, you know, there's this slow build of anxiety of what am I missing? But it's just something nice about being out of range.
Yeah. It's very, I don't know, very old school.
Very. And again, I think, you know, people have a hard time imagining that, like what it was like to not just be able to say, you know, I'll meet you at Pearl Street Mall, you know, sometime this afternoon, I'll text you when I'm there. Like, no, you had to make a plan. We're going to meet at this point at this time. And if we don't meet, you know, all right, we're going to go here and you're going to go there and then we're going to meet back here, you know.
Right.
You had to have like everything like
pre-organized. And you just showed up
right.
because that was the plan and there was
right.
no way to change the plan.
Right.
So it was incredibly rude to not show up or or an emergency.
Yep. But now, you know, I mean, there's something really nice about it being so fluid, but at the same time, it's at the price of just like always being on.
Yeah. Totally random question. Has more to do with you being a longtime Boulderite and doesn't have to have anything to do with tech. Uh-huh. What's one thing that Boulder's missing that you'd love to see or bring back?
That's a good question. I don't know if there's anything specific I miss. There are a lot of like restaurants that I will occasionally miss. I miss like there being Dots downtown. I miss Rocky Mountain Joe's. Mm-hmm. I guess coming from the East Coast, I really miss dive bars. Boulder just like really is lacking in your neighborhood dive bar. Though, well, not that divey. The new Full Cycle downtown is as a bar is actually has a good neighborhood feel to it.
Yeah, it is missing. You know, the bars are either kind of super chic or total like CU student hangouts, and there's not really that just sort of neighborhoody kind of place.
Yeah.
I guess I miss there being some truly legit like local music venues beyond the Fox and Boulder Theater.
Yeah, I came here from Boston, and I just have always been surprised that for a college town, how limited the Boulder music scene seems.
Yeah. Although, you know, back in the 90s, there was a huge music scene here, and it seemed like actually the music scene was more in Boulder than it was even in Denver.
Yeah.
And then prices started to go up and people started leaving Boulder, and now there's not really much of a music scene.
Yeah.
There is. There definitely is, but there's not as big of a music scene in Boulder, and it's not as out front as it used to be.
Yeah.
And that makes me, as a music guy especially, a little sad that there's not a bunch of options to go check out music on a given Friday or any night of the week, really. Anything that I missed or that you'd like to add?
I don't think so.
All right. Spike, thanks very much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure to be here.
That was Spike Alakwa, founder of IndrasNet and longtime software developer and member of the tech community here in Boulder. You can learn more about IndrasNet at indra.com, and you can follow Spike on Twitter at SpikeX. The Boulder Tech Podcast is made possible in part by Glider, a Colorado-based community movement and nonprofit that produces Boulder's Ignite and TEDx events, as well as Boulder Startup Week. Learn more and consider a donation at glider.com. Thanks to Dojo 4 for providing space for our podcast studio, and to KGNU Community Radio for recording gear and studio usage. Our intro music is by Echo Deck. Hear more at echodeck.com. That's E-C-C-O-D-E-K. Our outro music is by Earthrise Sound System. You'll find them at earthrisesoundsystem.com. The Boulder Tech Podcast is produced by me, Joel Davis. Your feedback, criticisms, comments, and guest suggestions are welcome. Reach me at joel@dojo4.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here for the next episode of the Boulder Tech Podcast.